sometimes when I'm in certain frames of mind, particularly on very hot days around the North Circular, I can feel time radiating off of pre-moulded concrete lintels.
Welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography with John Rogers and Nick Papadimitriou. This is a show that looks at the rich tradition of early 20th century topographical walking guides to London and the South East and what use they might be to us today.
It's kind of like inlet valves for some unmediated cosmic energy.
Each week, we'll be taking a trip through the pages of a different book as if we are on a wayward topographical ramble.
Because I know they're actually just technology, they're applied machinery, but they seem to me almost to be kind of like storage vats of regional memory.
Hello, and welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, John Rogers, and my co-host, Nick Papadimitriou. This is a show that explores the world of early 20th century walking guides to London and the South East.
And this week, we're visiting South Harrow, or Roxeth as we prefer to call it, with T.L. Bartlett.
The Story of Roxeth by T.L. Bartlett. Chapter 1. Roxeth Before the Conquest. Frontinus to Leofwine. Most of the people who sleep inside the bounds of the ancient and extensive manor of Roxeth call it South Harrow. They know next to nothing of its boundaries, its traditions, its history. To them it is not a heritage, but a characterless extension of London's dormitory with the usual complement of shops, buses, a cinema, and a station. The station is blatantly but wrongly named South Harrow. It was therefore an ill day for Roxeth and its good name when a blue enamel board labelled South Harrow Station for Roxeth and Northolt appeared in the Tollgate Road. It was followed by another at Headstone, live at North Harrow, a place of tone. The era of progress, false values, and grab had started. The obliteration of beautiful lanes, ancient footpaths, old place names, old boundary stones, old memories, and old memorials had begun. Roxeth and Headstone were under a cloud, a thick, nasty cloud, but truth has a high survival value. After two centuries, the honest English tongue triumphed over the Latinized Norman lisp, and I have little doubt that Headstone and Roxeth, good old Roxy, will one day come into their own again and triumph over North and South Harrow. Of the thousands who use South Harrow Station, few remember what old Roxeth was like. They never knew its fields and lanes, its farms and cottages, its marshes and orchards. They never sat on the white posts where Woolworth stands or went courting down the long mile. They did not attend its drag hunts, visit its shooting butts, or watch Charles Fleet rising in his balloon over its fields on bank holidays. They did not see the early motors jib at Harrow Hill or follow Dodd's coal cart down the long mile to pick up the remains of a Wilbur Wright aeroplane that had flown all the way from Wembley Park.
That was a reading by Hayley LePayne from T.L. Bartlett's The Story of Roxeth, and the music there was by Kate Morris. One of the first things we should say about this peculiar book, really, is that this is a show that looks at early 20th century walking guides, but this book isn't really a walking guide as such. It's more a kind of, I don't know, I sort of describe it as like a mytho-historical compendium of kind of fact and fiction and whimsy. Nick, you chose this book. Please enlighten us with why, because despite reading it and exploring it yesterday, I'm still not entirely sure. I think you've got a deep, deep reason for choosing this book.
Well, Roxeth first snagged itself in my consciousness about 9 years ago when I was reading the Victoria County History of Middlesex, and I found a reference to South Harrow also being known as Roxeth, and then in brackets it said afterwards Old English, where the rooks drink. And at that time I was just beginning to formulate my topographical interests, and I also had an interest in natural history, and so for that reason that description stayed in my mind then probably in about August 2000, I went up to visit Northolt Aerodrome, and I visited a tiny little bookshop in Ickenham, now sadly gone, and I saw The History of Roxeth by T.L. Bartlett in the window, complete with two rooks on the dust cover. I'm afraid to say I didn't buy it. But for years afterwards, that book haunted me until David Tobin, who runs the Walden Bookshop in Camden Town, phoned me one day and said that he had a copy of the book for me, and I went in and bought it. But in the meantime, I had visited Roxeth a couple of times. I'd managed to trace the Roxbourne stream using an OS map, and I went down there a couple of times and paid visits. I think it's an astonishing book. I call it a deep topography.
Now, what do you mean by that, Nick? A deep topography, because that is that's your own term. We've talked about it, I think, in the first episode of this show, and we defined the terminology. It has kind of caught on now. If you Google deep topography, you will get something come back. When I first met you, Nick, and I made a video about you, or, you know, with you. It wasn't intending to be about you, actually. It was intending to be about a walk, but all I had on the camera was you soliloquising. That was the only reference to deep topography. Explain how this book, this whimsical mytho-historical book to a part of London which no longer carries its name, is a deep topography.
Well, all I can say is that if the term deep topography is beginning to catch on, I'd better hurry up and work out what the hell it means. I became very interested in topography and all the different aspects of what I could see in the landscape, natural history, car crashes, the movement of plants across the landscape over centuries. I became interested in that, started writing a kind of retro-modernist verse about it and called it deep topography. That was before I ever discovered there was anything called psychogeography. So I adamantly dig my heels in and stick with that term now. I think that this book is astonishing. And when I finally got the copy from David Tobin and read it, I thought, this guy is doing the sort of thing that I want to do. And what I particularly like about it is the notion of an individual who's almost organically embedded in their landscape and is a kind of protector of the memories of that landscape. To me, that would seem to be an ideal state of being. And as you know, I'm trying to replicate that type of relationship with my own area, Childs Hill in Golders Green.
That's another area as well that people probably wouldn't have heard of before, would it? Childs Hill is not a name. It is mentioned in a short story by Will Self, I think, in The Quantity Theory of Insanity. I think there's a person that keeps losing his bike that lives in Childs Hill, possibly based on you, given your association with Will. Should we play another little reading from the book to give a bit more of a spirit of T.L. Bartlett's quite amazing little tome?
The Birds of Roxeth, The Elimination of Beauty, 1900 to 1948. The face of Roxeth has changed. Its lanes, its trees, its birds have gone. And to compensate for its loss of open spaces, sunlight, natural food and natural beauty, its children have electric light, orange juice and cinemas. Roxeth is no longer its old self. It is absorbed into London, and the changes from fields towards slums are called progress. My earliest memories of Roxeth are of apple trees and huntsmen, birds and snow. Many birds and much snow. There were times when the 12 farms, the marshes, the lanes and the orchards between Roxeth and Ruislip were covered to a depth of 4 feet, and only the elms and tallest hawthorn hedges then stood out above the snow. They were sad times for the poor. The parochial soup kitchens were kept busy. The gulls were tempted to visit London. That was their first taste of London's fine large sprats and the beginnings of London's annual white invasion. It was a sad time for the birds, but worse times were to follow, for most of the countryside between Roxeth Marshes and Ruislip Reservoir is now buried under a 30-foot fall of suburban bricks and mortar which does not melt. The elms, stunted oaks, willows and hawthorn hedges which linked man to the birds are gone. You cannot stir a flower without troubling a star, nor lay waste the green things of the earth without hurting birds and man.
Reading again by Hayley LePain from T.L. Bartlett's The Story of Roxeth. It's a wonderful book. So apart from the things that we've already covered, there's things in this book. There's a couple of peculiarities, because things such as the reading that Hayley's just done there, you might find in other books. I'm thinking of a book like The Story of Leighton, which I've got a copy of, which is a similar kind of book, and it was trying to educate local children in the 1920s about where they lived as it was undergoing quite rapid change. But then there are things in this book which are just so peculiar. There's a couple of pages where he just lists birds that he spotted in the area, such as the mealy redpoll, the nuthatch, and the snow bunting, birds I've never heard of. And there's also the script of a play that was written for the would have been either centenary or the millennium celebrations?
The 11th centenary in 1945.
Ah, right. And it's a play called The Thane of Roxy. And the first line of the play reads, Saxon children are playing in the fields we seek to preserve for the children of suburbia. Nick, what were the sort of themes that you particularly were drawn to in this book, and how does it lead into the walk that we did yesterday, actually?
Well, the presence of rooks in the area is central to the name of Roxeth. Roxeth is first mentioned in 845 AD in a Saxon parchment, referring to a thane passing some land over to a local dignitary. That's where Roxeth is first picked up as a name historically. It's where it first enters history, if you like. And Roxeth means the dwelling of rooks, or the place where rooks drink, or possibly the rook's heath. Bartlett talks endlessly about how rooks clustered along the Roxbourne, the little stream that flows down from Harrow on the hill and runs down through Roxeth, through Roxeth Marshes, now sadly gone, and then through what is now South Ruislip towards the Yedding Brook. It joins that river just south of the Western Avenue today, just south of Northolt Aerodrome. That was one of the things I picked up on particularly, because when I first walked in the area and went down the Roxbourne, I saw lots of crows. I didn't think they were rooks, I thought they were carrion crows, but I figured that it was close enough to create that historic resonance. In that piece that was just read by Hayley, she talks about the arrival of the gulls. Of course, gulls didn't start coming inland in any number until the 1880s. It's mentioned in W.H. Hudson's The Birds of London, when the crows came into London and flocked around the Serpentine sometime in the 1880s. Many people took time off of lunch to go and feed them and to stare at them. It had never been seen before.
Well, there were lots of gulls the other day, weren't there, when we were over in Roxbourne, or Roxeth, Roxbourne, Roxy something. You tried to claim the other day that Roxy Music had got their name from Roxeth, and you're sitting there in this studio in Borough High Street, stern face looking at me as if, of course, that is the only possible way that Roxy Music obtained their name. When it was only when I got home I realised that Brian Eno is famously from Norwich, isn't he? Or certainly from sort of Norfolk, and I imagine there's never been anywhere near South Harrow. But
can I just say something about that?
I'm sure you've...
The reason why I claimed that was to wind Tim Bradford up.
Ah.
Now, I should add here that we asked Tim Bradford, who wrote the Groundwater Diaries, to come along with us on our walk, seeing as we were following the Roxbourne.
Yeah.
And the Groundwater Diaries is a lovely book. It was a big inspiration and irritant for me when I read it, because I had my own project running, which is called River Run Barnet, and you can see that on my website at www.middlesexcountycouncil.org.uk.
He manages to shoehorn that in to every programme, relevant or not. But what you should do before looking at middlesexcountycouncil.org.uk is have a look at Tim Bradford's wonderful Groundwater Diaries, which is certainly belongs in any kind of canon of London books. I've not read it. I've said that, giving it a massive puff, having not read the book, but you have, Nick. And tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, prior to this book, the only extant publication that looked at the lost rivers of London in any detail was Nicholas Barton's The Lost Rivers of London from 1961. John's laughing his head off at me there. And I picked up a copy of this book on the suggestion of a friend of mine. I was outrageously jealous when I read it, I'll tell you. But it's an extremely good book, and Tim does his research very well. Basically, what happened was Tim Bradford had a series of recurring dreams about a river and about his wife in Poconet 90, I think, drowning in the river. And this prompted him to start studying the rivers of London. I'm sorry if you're listening, Tim, and I haven't quite done you justice, but it's something like that. And Tim, one of the things, it's a lightweight and humorous book, although the research is pretty robust. And one of the things Tim likes to pick up on is the relationship between punk bands and rivers. For instance, when he follows the Westbourne down from Hampstead down to Chelsea, he refers to the different bands that are associated with it. For instance, Sid Vicious and Johnny Rotten, who had a squat in Hampstead in the mid-70s. Kilburn and the High Roads, because of course. The Westbourne flows through Kilburn. Not quite a punk band, but beginning to edge that way. And famously, The Clash, who lived in Westbourne Grove and thereabouts. That's why I brought the Roxy Music connection in. I just wanted to see if Tim would swallow it, but unfortunately he didn't.
That was a lot more skillful, that reference, than it appeared at the time, because it just appeared banal as we were standing outside South Harrow Station. So that was really a good bit of work you did there, Nick. Also, of course, I suppose you can link it up to psychogeography, can't you? Because the punks are into situationism. Malcolm McLaren was into psychogeography a bit, wasn't he?
Well, you can do that, John. For myself, I'm going to go back to Child's Hill.
Should we play a little clip of Tim talking about the Groundwater Diaries in situ when we were walking yesterday? And I think I was sort of possibly trying to get out of the fact that I hadn't read the book. And so I just sort of thought, well, I'll ask the author what it's about rather than read it directly.
I rest my case.
What case is that, Nick?
It's a river valley.
Yeah. So, Tim, did you write about the Roxbourne in the Groundwater Diaries?
I didn't, no. No, I didn't come out this far. I came out as... I did the Brent and then basically got hacked off. Went to buy my daughter some Disney merchandise and got on the tube, you know. A lot of it was done on how I was feeling on a particular day. So some days I'd walk for, you know, the whole day. And other days I'd just get on public transport and go home. And... once I headed out towards the suburbs, that tends to be my response. I tend to get a bit asthmatic in the suburbs.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
So it was kind of a psychogeographical kind of quest.
I wouldn't really use that term.
You wouldn't?
No.
But it was a response to Ian Sinclair's work, in a way.
Well, I was saying to Nick, I was inspired by that, and also by kind of a couple of articles I'd read by Julian Cope in the mid-90s. Oh. Walking in the West Country near his home, yeah, on the Ridgeway, and it's that kind of thing, really. And I started to have really strange dreams. I didn't wet the bed or anything, but...
you cried?
Then read about the new river being quite close by.
Yeah.
Because I live on Riversdale Road.
Ah, yeah, no,
and,
well.
And so that got me started drinking extra strong lager to douse.
Yes.
To try and feel the natural borders, because I tended to see people that were off their faces on, are we allowed to mention Brands, Special Brew?
Yeah, Special Brew. I mean, particularly as you talk about Riversdale Road and Brownswood Road, those areas Brown is certainly an association of that area, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, and so that was a way of getting into it, really, the sort of trying to find the rivers underneath where I lived. And then it snowballed. Ah. Then it became a monster.
Tsunamied, even, maybe.
Possibly, but it tsunamied in all directions, you know, not just one direction.
That's a good point. I suppose where I personally feel a limitation in my own palette of references is when I come to places like this, where it is kind of rural. Although we've come to it via a sort of urban way, there's a sort of rural sense to it, and I just don't have a vocabulary for it.
You just mean you don't know the names of the trees and plants.
Yes,
at all,
But it's like I've often said, you know, knowing can also interfere with perception. So if a naturalist came here, he'd see certain things, but he'd miss out completely on other things. Mm. One of the things I found walking is that my consciousness goes off in different directions. Sometimes I'm far more bird conscious and I will walk all day and hardly notice the plants. Other times I'm far more plant conscious and I won't really notice the configurations of the landscape, for instance.
Other times I'll be very aware of the structure of the underlying geology, but I won't see anything of nature at all. And it's a bit like a computer that just isn't powerful enough. You can only really do one thing with it at a time.
I think that depends on who you're walking with. And so the context of the walk and who's there is quite important. So here we might be talking about the names of plants, as if you're walking on your own. If I was on my own, I might have my sketchbook and wouldn't know their names, but might study them and do little tiny studies. So you look at, yeah. You do look at different things. We're talking about bigger themes and larger features maybe when we're in a group.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have to impress myself with the history I didn't know when I'm on my own.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So that was a walk that we did yesterday morning following the Roxbourne through Roxeth. It was a good day, wasn't it, Nick?
It was superb, despite a somewhat late start because of problems on the Piccadilly line.
Okay, I was late.
I was early. I was there at 8 o'clock and came down from Rayner's Lane.
What were you doing there at 8 o'clock?
I wanted to follow the original course of Rayner's Lane down between... It was actually the road from Roxeth to Pinner. Before the suburb appeared. I followed down and came out by the station and met you and Peter there. Of course, South Harrow is the name of the station, and that's one of the problems T.L. Bartlett has. He feels that the name, which was foisted onto the area by the London Transport Passenger Board, has occluded the original location name-wise. The label has covered over the original community and the routes that go back to the original Saxon manor and village.
Also, doesn't it go back, the boundaries, as Bartlett mentions, the boundaries of Roxeth go back to the Romans. He does quite a lot on the Romans, doesn't he? He speculates that Julius Caesar passed through the area. And he also talks about how Roxeth's boundaries are based on the Roman pagi boundaries. And wasn't London divided into four... Pagi, is that right? And I don't know, wasn't this uncovered by somebody who is one of your sort of prophets, isn't he? Sir Montagu Sharp.
I sense that you nearly said Sir Montagu Tragascus there, the founder of the notorious Northern Heights Footpath Association, but that's another story. Yes, Sir Montagu Sharp was a one-time chairman of the Middlesex County Council and also a co-founder of the Royal Society of the Protection of Birds, with W.H. Hudson, who I mentioned earlier, who wrote Birds of London. He was also a bit of an amateur archaeologist, and he was a member of the London and Middlesex Archaeological Society. But he posited that the landscape of Middlesex was divided up into a grid alignment, which he called pagi. They were basically administrative areas. And his theory is that the mother churches of Middlesex built on the sites of field shrines that were erected by the Romans. He first put this idea forward in Middlesex in British, Roman and Saxon times, 1919. I've got a signed copy, by the way, which was a gift to the Reverend Ernest Westlake, who incidentally founded the Order of Woodcraft Chivalry that I mentioned a couple of programmes ago. I'm sure everyone remembers.
There is an infusion in a lot of the things we've been talking about, particularly Bartlett's book and Sir Montagu Sharp and Sir Ernest Westlake and that organisation which he set up. There's a sort of quasi-paganism about it, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they were all into magic mushrooms myself. But
what were they called in those days, magic mushrooms? Didn't they have a name? Was it Corkers or something?
My late brother claims that he met a tramp who lived in a wood in Mill Hill who took them in the 1930s and called them Corkers. I've often wondered what it would have been like taking magic mushrooms in the 1930s before you had the whole sort of cultural framework of psychedelia and rock and roll and the rest of it. Imagine listening to Hitler make a speech from Berlin when you're out of your box on 200 mushrooms. It'd be most odd.
It would. I think it'd be odd to be in that time anyway because we're now. But
to say about Sir Montagu Sharp, I tried to apply his theories. I took a 125,000th ordnance survey map and of the area, and I drew out the pagi markings on a sheet of tracing paper.
A bit like the ones on the book. There's one in the book here.
Yes, exactly like that. Mm. And I found it didn't fit at all, but that might be down to my mathematics. Certainly the churches weren't aligned. But what we did yesterday, incidentally, for the benefit of the reader, was that we headed north from the station up along the railway line to where it's carried over the gully that carries the Roxbourne westwards. And the gully necessitates the building of a vast viaduct. Mm. And we then followed the stream westwards through the old Newton sewage farm site, which is now a nature reserve, and then out onto Newton Fields, which is a public park.
Excellent. Well, what we in that public park, we encountered a true local, and he had some thoughts on the area and the population of the area as well.
He did indeed.
Years ago, somebody comes in over, there's an entrance over there from the roadway, and people come in and feed these crows, and a bloke stands in the middle of the field, got a bag full of food, and he waits for a little while, and a whole lot that are in the area will congregate round him. And they're just a blooming nuisance. Because I've got an allotment over there, and they used to all get over there, a lot of the crows, and rip everything apart. Because they're so mischievous, aren't they, crows?
Do they get on at all with the seagulls?
They don't bother each other.
Right.
No, not at all. And one year, a couple of years ago, there was even a few jackdaws amongst them as well. But people used to think, because there were so many of these crows, they're carrying crows, so many of them, they used to think they were rooks. But they're not, because the rooks, I think, a bit smaller.
Have you ever seen rooks over here?
Not here, no. No, they don't have any rooks here anymore. Might have done a few years ago. But there's hundreds of these crows. And in the windy days, they're all on the floor, because it's too much. If you walked out there with a handful of food, you'd be surrounded by them. And I don't understand why people bother to feed them. Because I think they're a waste of time. Myself. What do they do? Nothing.
I love the way that he didn't like rooks because he just thought they didn't do anything.
Anthropomorphism written large. Anthropocentrism, sorry.
And also, I suppose we should say, we're running out of time. We've only got a few minutes left, but it was another walk that we didn't really finish, did we? I mean, I'm not sure if there was a fixed ending as such, but we sort of run out of time again, as we've tended to do on a few of these walks.
I think we went for the intensive rather than the extensive. I tried to be generous and curtail the walk at South Ruislip, but we didn't even get halfway there. But it was very intense.
And in about 30 seconds, could you say, you carried on walking, where did you end up in about, have you got less than 30 seconds to tell me?
After the boys got on at Rainer's Lane, I headed south again, down the original Rainer's Lane, through Roxeth and down towards Northolt and Greenford. I visited the old post office aerials at Pett's Hill. Stunning views across the River Brent Valley towards Ealing and Hanger Lane. Absolutely astonishing. And that was at dusk. I just felt myself lifted out of my body and I blended with Middlesex.
Well, how wonderful. What a lovely image. Before we go off air, the most important thing I have to do, actually, is to say hi to Oliver and Joseph, my two beautiful boys, who didn't want me to come this evening and nearly came with me. That would have been quite a different show. We'd like to do our we need to do our thank yous now. In what have we got? We've got 50 seconds. Let's see. It's like when they do the news, isn't it, in 30 seconds. We've got to say thank you to Tim Bradford for tolerating
us. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thanks, Tim. You were brilliant company. We'd love to walk with you again. Whether you'll walk with us again, I don't know, we'll have to wait and see, but hopefully we weren't too annoying. Thank you very much to Peter Knapp, our diligent photographer, to Hayley LePain for her wonderful readings. You can email us at deeplibrary@yahoo.com. Thank you very much to all the people that have emailed us so far. We have a website at venturesintopography.wordpress.com, and the podcast of last week's show is now available on the Resonance website. Thank you very much for listening. And I think that is all we have time for. Bye-bye.